Hello, everyone. My name is Kanai Kapadia, and this is Hindsight. Hindsight is produced by KGK and Company, a data-driven value creation partner who practices accountability for delivering measurable financial value. To learn more about the firm, its proven methods, and how prospective clients can receive a complimentary one-day assessment of where your company may have overlooked revenue and profit opportunities, go online to www.kgkcompany.com. On this episode of Hindsight, I'm joined by Michael Brannick, who until recently was CEO of the Arrivo Group family of companies and is now chairman of the board. Mike began his career as a title insurance underwriter before moving into commercial banking. He then joined Workforce Unlimited, which is the original Arrivo Group company that his mom founded, ultimately taking over as CEO and driving expansion with four acquisitions over the past 10 years. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kanai. It's great to be here.
Can you paint a picture of what Workforce Unlimited looked like when you first joined?
Oh, wow. Sure. As you know, my mother was running it at that time. We had two branches, one in Mount Airy and one in Atkinville, both in North Carolina. We had about 20 employees somewhere in that neighborhood. We were doing about $15 million in revenue, and our two largest customers made up about 70% of our business. It was very much a family feel. Everyone knew each other and very informal and, you know, took care of each other. And the company had a great reputation for having high standards and being a very professional organization and very much involved in the community.
So you joined to help grow the business, is my understanding, right?
That was the plan.
Yeah. So if you fast forward to today, could you break down what are the companies within the Arrivo Group and what does each of them provide to its customers?
Sure. Arrivo Group is our parent umbrella brand, and our flagship company, as you mentioned, is Workforce Unlimited. Workforce is primarily a light industrial, blue-collar staffing organization. We do a ton of skilled labor, seasonal temp, temp to hire, direct hire placement for manufacturing and warehouse organizations, primarily throughout the triad of North Carolina, but we go up into Southern Virginia and then down into as far south as Charlotte for Workforce. We then also have Arrivo Professional Services, which is our IT digital practice, and that's a little bit smaller practice. It's based out of Charlotte. We work with customers all over the country, wherever's needed. We then have Arrivo Management Group, which does some outsourcing and some consulting work, primarily in the human capital space, a little bit in finance and technology, some RPOs and BPOs and things of that nature.
Yeah. As you think about each of those businesses, and I imagine your answer would be different to each, but what do you think are the key success factors in each of those businesses?
Well, I think one thing the Arrivo Group umbrella encompasses for all of them is a real strong culture. It's something that my mother had done a great job at before I got there. And the culture has evolved without question, but it's certainly something that I think most employees are really proud to work there. They feel like it's an environment where you can be safe and take risk, celebrate wins. You know, our motto is work hard, play hard, and eat well. That's something my mother started years ago. And I think that really sums it up in a way. We're a very competitive, but a very competitive team. We love to win, but not at each other's expense.
Interesting. What is the eat well part?
When you're celebrating or having a meeting, you make sure that you've got good food there, right? And that's evolved as well. I remember a time when meetings had pizza and stromboli for lunch. We tried to get that a little more healthy over the years, but yeah.
That's fun. I see the family part of that creep in a little bit.
A little bit.
You know, one of the things you shared with me was that as you're trying to take a business in a particular direction, you really need to make sure people are following you. Can you talk about your firsthand experiences, either seeing that going really well or perhaps leaving folks behind and realizing you need to rewind a little bit and pick up where they are?
Yeah, I think my experience as a young leader, manager, as well as other younger managers I've witnessed throughout my journey, the tendency is to just execute and not really worry about the people around you. You feel like people get excited about growth or more revenue, more profitability, and they really don't if they don't understand what's in it for them and why it's happening. And especially when you're bringing change into the mix, which I brought a lot of change into the mix. I learned some pretty hard lessons about, does it do any good to charge the hill if there's nobody following you? I started at Workforce in particular, I was almost robotic. I had this very firm line between who I was as an individual outside of work and who I was at work. And what I found was people don't want to follow robots, the AI movement right now. They want to know that you're human. And seeing vulnerability is something that I think is really important to be able to connect with folks in a very empathetic way. They have their own struggles. And if you think about COVID and the stuff going on around the world today, everybody, I think, is searching for empathy and support. And it's easy, I think, for some folks to feel like a victim. But all that aside, having a leader who you feel like you connect with, who's going through it with you, is really, really important. And it's something that I look back on, what I guess about a 12, 13 year journey with the Arrivo Group. And it's been a real critical element to my success.
Yeah. When did the robot in you stop and say, I think I have a problem here and I need to change the way I'm leading?
It really was 2016. It was the first down year that I experienced coming to Workforce. We saw a loss of volume and revenue. The girl I was dating at the time left me early that year. So I was really struggling with a lot of things personally and professionally, trying to find my way. And I went from feeling like I had everything figured out to asking a lot of questions about how effective am I really? What impact am I having really? What's really important to me? What's important to the folks around me? I just really started asking a lot of questions. And it was interesting. In that year, we had our annual recognition event, and I was doing my closing remarks, and I shared with folks for the first time a lot about what I was struggling with personally and professionally. I remember specifically calling out that my girlfriend had left me. By the way, she came back. We're married now. We're two beautiful boys. So I clearly learned something and got my act together. But sharing with them that I was questioning my ability as a leader. Was I failing as a leader? And I called out some employees in the organization who I thought had really shown great examples of leadership, both inside and outside of the organization. I'll never forget, I was nearly in tears. And more people came up to me at the end of that session and hugged me tight and long, thanked me for sharing what I shared, let me know some of their own things that they were struggling with. For me, it was really a pivotal moment in my professional journey, learning how important it was to connect with people and let them know it's okay to be human.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still work to be done, but it's
always,
we're all human for sure.
Right.
Yeah. When we talk about it from a business standpoint, certainly your personal experience, I'll call it, forced you to be introspective a bit. And you sort of had this outcome unexpectedly that people saw you as the human being you are and vice versa more so. But when you look at it from a business standpoint, was that a problem in the business that needed to be addressed in your mind? Was that part of the realization?
Well, I think it was a problem. It hadn't prevented us from growing at that point, but I don't think you can continue to scale and end up adding additional layers of leadership within an organization if you don't have other people driving and following. And there were probably a few key managers, even entry-level managers, who were really key to the organization's success, who probably weren't bought into the strategy and or really following me. And over time, when we went into COVID, I would say that 95%+ of the organization was behind me no matter what. We absolutely saw some real meaningful changes in the organization's, I think, commitment as well as alignment from the employees to take us to the next level.
Mm-hmm. When you saw that buy-in, which, by the way, how did you get that buy-in?
Well, after, I think, making a little bit more of an empathetic connection with folks, I always tried to communicate what was in it for them, but I really started focusing a lot more on what they wanted, what their goals were. So, I mean, one of the things that I think is really important anytime I'm trying to hire a new executive or senior leader of the organization, I spend a lot of time focused on what's important to them. What are their professional goals? Where do they see themselves in 3-5 years or beyond that? Because what I'm looking for is an opportunity to take what they say they want and connect it with what we're trying to deliver as an organization. And if I can make that connection, then normally you get the buy-in and you get it very quickly. So I think that's really, really important, is focusing on what's important to them and making sure that they feel like they've been heard and that they feel like what they want to accomplish is possible if they join our team.
Yeah, that's a great lesson. Understanding people's objectives takes time, and it changes over time too, right? A lot of people don't actually know what they want in the next 3 to 5 years. And so it's not simply question and answer, it's question and coaching and answer, and it changes over time.
It really does. I think the coaching element is a big one, especially if you're starting with a new employee. One, you want them to feel very, very supported early on, and I think very, very clear on how to get integrated in the organization, which a lot of my coaching, especially if I'm looking at a new executive or senior level manager in the organization, the first 30 days is, I don't want you doing anything but meeting with people and listening. Listen and learn. And one of our execs now comments on, she'll never forget that I continue to just reinforce for that first 30 days at least, just listen and learn, listen and learn. We don't need anything else other than listening and learning, right? Because it's so important to be able to develop relationships if you're new to the organization, to understand the culture and to start to build trust and credibility. And if you're smart and you've got great ideas, that's all going to come. That's fine. But if the folks aren't connected with you, they don't feel like they necessarily understand what you're about. You start coming in with some changes or recommendations. Doesn't matter how smart you are. If it doesn't resonate with them, it can be disruptive and problematic.
Yeah, I mean, it's an attack almost, unless you've built that trust and credibility first. And the same team mentality, right?
Right.
Yeah. Once you started doing this, what did you see change from, let's look at it from a P&L leader standpoint, right? Because ultimately, this stuff, it's how you wanted to manage the business, and that's fine. But it needs to make some economic sense too. What did you see happen from a results standpoint?
I think the first thing is more alignment. And I think teamwork in a big way. Folks having ownership in their role and being clear on what their contribution is to the organization. So I really saw the team evolve in terms of their ability to look at the organization. Let's say we're doing a SWOT or we're analyzing some data through some reporting or whatever. Mm-hmm. The maturity that our team had, especially going into COVID, we saw a lot of turnover like most companies when we came out of COVID or during COVID. But from probably 2015, 16 or so up until COVID, the team really evolved and matured. And we didn't have necessarily Fortune 500 talent helping us lead the organization, right? We're still a relatively small company. And a lot of folks from small towns in Surrey County and Yadkin County there, or Southern Virginia, but their ability to work together as a team and their maturity level at being able to take data and digest it very quickly to drive action. So, okay, we've looked at this, we've assessed it, and we've identified action that needs to be taken to move the business forward to help fulfill our strategy and our vision was really impressive. You don't realize until maybe you lose it a little bit, which, you know, again, you see a lot of turnover in COVID and since COVID, you lose a little bit of that. So you recognize how valuable it was at the time.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Because I think there's some skill development within all of that too, right? Knowing how to use data is a skill that's different from just general collaboration or alignment. So when you think about core values of the business, does the business have core values that it focuses on? Is it work hard, play hard, eat well?
That's more of a motto or maybe a mantra. No, we definitely have core values. We have four: integrity, respect, commitment, and accountability. And in that order, intentionally, and those four intentionally, and no more and no less.
Those are good. It guides the organizational decision making. You can't create rules for everything. And so I think when you establish guardrails like this that people can refer to and apply in the day-to-day decisions they have to make, it guides the business appropriately.
We're very intentional about the values, and we talk about them often. We do use them to make decisions, but we kind of use them as the cornerstone to drive high-performing teamwork. When we're doing new hire orientation, there's a value session that I lead and facilitate and always ask folks, is there anything missing? And the thing that comes up most often is teamwork. Why don't we have teamwork as a value? And my response is that, okay, let's go through each of these and talk about, as long as these four are in place, do we or do we not have teamwork? And I take some time to do that and explain how we get to that. But at the end of the day, you can talk about those values intentionally the way that we talk about them. And everybody always says, yeah, teamwork's there. No question. Mm-hmm. As long as those values are in check, then we have teamwork. Okay, got it. We don't need it. It's already there inherently.
Yeah. How do you make sure the values are in check? Because you only see part of what's happening in the business. So how do you know in the end?
Well, at one, I think it's a feeling. You just kind of have a feeling from the team, but you really do witness it. One of the biggest things is conflict. Conflict gets in the way of productivity in any relationship. Just think about spousal relationships, parenting relationships. There's always conflict somewhere at some point. Now, how it's dealt with is, I think, what ultimately tells you whether or not you've got a high-functioning relationship or a really toxic relationship. So one of the things that we are very mindful of, we talk a little bit about in the value session, is, okay, what are threats to our values? Well, the two biggest things that we speak to are gossiping and complaining. So if you're walking into a branch or you are at a work function where there's folks talking, if you hear complaining or you hear gossiping, the values are not in check, right? So I think that's a big way. And I think on the flip side, or on the contrary, if you see people having conflict, but resolving it and resolving it on their own, and then talking about that openly, then okay, everything's not rosy all the time. There's going to be conflict. Well, okay, when we spot it, how's it dealt with? And are folks able to talk about it openly? And that's something that we really, really encourage. Leadership in general has nothing to do with the job title. Everyone in the organization is expected to be a leader. And again, that's part of living the values. So if you see someone else gossiping, it's up to you to shut it down. That's part of being accountable. That's part of integrity. That's part of being committed to the success of the organization, committed to the team in general. I think you can bring it all back to the values. And if you don't have gossiping and complaining, you know, what else can you potentially have? Maybe some goofing off and stuff like that. But in reality, if you've got the right number of people and the right amount of work, there's no goofing off unless the work isn't getting done. At the end of the day, there's a lot of ways to see that the values are real, that people are living them. And it can be a tough task, but it starts with me and then it goes from there, and people have to see them in me and know that they can call me out in the event that they feel like I haven't honored a commitment or something of that nature, and that I'm going to own it, and then I'm going to clean it up and fix it.
Mm-hmm. So you're seeing them be tested, essentially.
Absolutely.
Right? That makes sense. Do you also do workforce surveys and that sort of?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have our own internal survey twice a year. We do some best places to work surveys.
Okay.
And we use the data from those as well. And we use the internal surveys as input into our strategy sessions so that when we are looking at the organization and what we need to do to move the organization forward, everybody's got a voice. Just because you're not in the room working the strategy, well, we heard you and here are two or three common themes that came up and their input in our strategy session. Here's action that's being taken as a result.
Yeah, makes sense. Let me switch gears on you. Let's talk about the business of recruiting. And we can go all the way back to when you joined, if you like. Two customers, 75% of revenue. That's quite the revenue concentration situation. Both to some degree, that's how you grow, as well as it's a significant risk to the business. Mm-hmm. So how did you unravel that and get the business to where it is today?
When I came in, I actually came in as CFO before CEO, and my number one focus was to dilute that concentration. And I certainly didn't want to do it by reducing the amount of business we were doing with them, right? So yeah. I personally went out on a pretty big sales effort to grow the organization, and we saw some big wins there in a couple of years. We then launched a sales team relatively quickly to try to help add to the growth. And our first acquisition we found in 2014, I'm trying to think of the exact year. We took that concentration down every year. We were very intentional about it. And I believe it probably was about 2015 or 2016, somewhere in that neighborhood, that neither one of them were greater than 15% in revenue. And by the time we got to 2019, neither one of them were greater than 10% of the revenue within the organization.
Yeah, I don't know any other ways of getting out of revenue concentration than growth. And so it certainly seems like that was the case here. You shared with me that over time, the organization was very much service focused, and there was a need to more deliberately transition it to being a sales organization. Can you expand on the story you just told and how maybe it corresponds to that?
Absolutely. I was probably the leading salesperson early on when I came on board, and we've had some solid sales folks come on board since then, but even not to the level necessarily that I contributed in those first few years that I came on board. So one of the things that I definitely learned the hard way, especially as we went into COVID, was the importance of having a very strong sales engine, which we never fully developed. We are doing much better now. It's been a focus of ours for the past couple of years. I think this year is the first year that we're starting to see some real benefit from it, and we're going to see that exponentially increase going forward. Lots of momentum. But once you start growing and you have all this momentum, it can be easy to say, okay, wait a minute. We're going to keep growing, but now I'm going to take my eye off of growing customers myself and start focusing on infrastructure, building infrastructure, or adding more people or another layer of management or whatever it is in order to support the growth that's coming. Well, if you're not fully committed to driving the growth doesn't continue to go. You're going to hit a ceiling at some point. And that's what we experienced was we stopped seeing double-digit growth. Probably, I think 2018 or so was the last, or 2017 was probably the last year that we saw double-digit growth. And I look back and it's pretty simple. We just put too much energy investment into infrastructure and people. And it's something that I've seen at the executive level, not just for myself, but most leaders and even experienced executives gravitate to one of three things. It's either sales and customers and growing them. It's tools and infrastructure. Or it's, no, we just need more people in general. And my biggest learning lesson in all of this is I don't care how big you get or what's happening. If sales is not number one, nothing else matters, because you might have a pandemic. You might have a big customer drop off, no fault of your own, right? They're still a customer, but their volume drops by 75 or 80%. The bottom line is the world is going to deal you something that you haven't expected that's different than what you've been experiencing. If you don't have a sales engine to offset that or overcome that, then you can find yourself in trouble. And that's, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say we found ourselves in trouble, but coming out of COVID, we found ourselves having to work really, really hard to rebuild the organization. And frankly, a lot of the infrastructure that we had built was kind of broken or irrelevant because we didn't have the growth and momentum that we had pre-COVID. One of my mentors says, drive the growth until things are smoking, right? And when they start smoking is when you can look at addressing infrastructure or push people until they say, hey, wait a minute, I'm overwhelmed. I've got too much. Okay, maybe now we need more people. But at the end of the day, let the sales drive those other things as opposed to getting too eager to make investments and stuff that if you just push a little harder and you just kept that focus in sales and driving new business and growing customers, then you should be able to continue with the momentum and continue to manage the growth.
Yeah. Revenue solves a lot of problems. Sometimes it doesn't solve them well, but
right?
It solves them.
Right.
I'm tracking on what you're saying. I think the tough part is that at a certain point, you don't get the luxury of choosing. You have to do all of these things and in a pretty calculated fashion. You know, yes, without revenue, you have no business. Without people to service that revenue well, you also don't have a business. And without the tools to make it still scalable and profitable, as opposed to growing a business and being a business owner who makes less, which happens a
right.
lot, you can also run into that issue. And so the importance of a scalable sales function certainly makes a lot of sense to me. What I'm curious about is understanding that all these things have to happen simultaneously and there's no luxury of choosing one. How are you keeping like the second to the people and the tools moving at what you feel is the appropriate pace?
Right. And don't get me wrong. I don't mean to imply that the other two don't matter, right?
Yeah.
Especially the people. The people matter tremendously. So first and foremost, if we just think about the people, I think a lot of it is them understanding where we're going, why we're going there, and what's in it for them. At the end of the day, what's in it for them is the most important. So, hey, yes, we're growing. It's a little stressful, but you're going to get the opportunity to do something you've never done before. How does that feel? And we want you to stay here and be successful for as long as you're willing and able, but how much more marketable do you end up being when you step up and you take on something that you've never had the opportunity to do, but it's because we're growing. It's because we just added that new customer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think opportunity, I guess, at the end of the day, I think is a big one. And making sure folks understand why that's good for them. And then let's not forget, you're going to get to make more money or you're going to get the opportunity to make more money. You'll get a bonus that you wouldn't have got if this thing goes well. So I think the people piece, they've got to be excited about the growth. And I think one of the ways, one, you've got to have the right people in the organization. They've got to want to grow. They've got to want opportunity. They've got to want to push themselves. We talk a lot about authentic failure in the organization. And hey, you can step up for this project, something you've never done before, but swing at it like you're trying to knock it out of the park, not like you're hoping you don't miss. And if you do miss or you end up stumbling and fall down, well, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and we're going to go at it again. Or maybe you let someone else take that project on and you go back to your other position. It's okay. We're not going to take you out back and shoot you. We're not going to fire you because you swung at something and you tried to step up and it didn't go as well as we all thought it would go. But when it does, wow, right? Success for the organization, success for that person, recognition for that person, income and incentive money. So many things happen. Respect and credibility, what they can be at home because of what they just did. So really just kind of developing the person, I think, is really important. Development in general. But they've got to understand what's in it for them. And as long as we go back to, they told us what their goals were, their goals line up with growth, with taking things on, with stepping up when you have the opportunity, being okay making mistakes. It's okay if you make a mistake. Let's learn from them. Let's make sure everybody else learns from it because we're just going to get better. I'd say that's the people piece. The systems piece is a little tougher, especially in this technology age, because with AI in particular, and even in our industry, you're seeing AI is it's very much in our industry. I see it as an accelerant to our industry. I know we've got recruiters worried about losing their jobs due to AI or technology, and we try to debunk that myth. There's still a lot of administrative tasks and a lot of tasks that have to be done that keep us from just connecting with people. Our purpose as an organization is to change people's lives. How do I change someone's life if I'm having to run a background check or review every resume that comes to my desk and things of that nature? And there are tools that can enhance productivity significantly. But by doing that, what it's really doing is taking your recruiters and giving them more time to spend with the candidates and the people before and after they're placed, or even the customers, right?
Yeah. And some of the AI usage is, I'll call it a time suck, and some of it's productive, right? And it takes trial and error to figure it out. Sometimes you want people undertaking that trial and error, and sometimes you don't.
Right.
I had an interesting experience just on a kind of side note. On Friday, I started a major recruiting effort of my own for the first time since LLM, the large language models, have really taken off. And it was interesting to see how many AI-generated answers I received to questions like, what are your objectives, career objectives, right? We were talking about that earlier. Yeah. It's a question I ask as well, because I'm looking for people who are trying to accomplish something and to give them that opportunity. And I received a lot of garbage.
Yeah.
So now what used to be pretty straightforward requires me to dig even deeper, right? So
sure.
Was that one a net win for the world in terms of efficiency or a net loss? I don't know.
Well, maybe in your specific case, it sounds like a net loss.
Yeah.
But you know, this is a great example of the tools and infrastructure discussion in general, because so often we have this belief that a certain tool is going to increase productivity or take away this major pain. And so often we don't anticipate the unintended consequence of implementing that tool. So I think that happens more often than not. So the key is, it takes a lot of time to truly bring something new in, especially something complex like AI or a major system upgrade. But it takes a huge investment, not just financially, but in time and learning in order to not only do it, but to do it well and leverage it to its fullest. Yeah, I would challenge most business owners, I bet if you polled and said, well, if you think about your core system, how well do you use that system? Are you using every feature to the extent that that system can be used? And I would bet that most entrepreneurs would say, we're doing 60 to 75% at best of what that system can do, as opposed to 85 to 95%. And so often what ends up happening is people complain about an existing system they're not even using well. So we decide to go get a new system and we find out, well, actually the old system wasn't that bad. On the infrastructure side and the tool side, I am not a lagger in technology at all. I'm very much a believer in moving with the times and seizing opportunity to take advantage of stuff. But I also want to do it very cautiously and methodically, because too often we think the tool's the answer and it's really not.
Yeah. I classify myself as a reformed technologist. And for that reason, a lot of times people think the problem is the system. And the reality is that they're not focusing on the business problem. And the business problems are things like sales is not consistent in how they're pitching, or things along these lines. And the solution to that, while I'm sure there are many software vendors who would like to tell us that the solution is a little bit of sales enablement technology, the real solution is make people pitch, hire better salespeople, put more process in place, things like this, not another piece of technology. And so you're kind of preaching to the choir.
Right, right. Something that you didn't say, but I think you said inadvertently, is consistency. If you have consistency, you're more than likely, at least you're consistent. I mean, but where you don't have consistency, a lot of times people start blaming tools or whatever, and it's more than likely a process or a messaging issue or a training issue. It's not necessarily the system.
Yeah. In most of the conversations I've had, in fact, I can't think of a single conversation I've had with folks like yourself where I asked them about what drove a P&L result, and they said technology.
Yeah, right.
Can't think of a single example. But if you look at the rhetoric and the dialogue in the marketplace about what drives business success, technology is a big part of that conversation. And so there's a bit of a dichotomy there. Now, I think psychology kind of plays into it, right? We tend to give people credit or blame rather than things.
Right.
But it's interesting nonetheless.
Yeah.
So you talk about standardization. That's a business problem, right? When you get to a point where you don't have consistency or standardization, you can't scale. And that's a business problem worth solving. And yes, maybe technology is part of the solution to that, but it's not the whole solution. And so if you look at it from a business problem standpoint, I think you end up well guided. And just to throw another example out there, you can't manage what you can't see. And so when your organization gets to a certain size, you need some visibility in order to be able to manage it. If you have 100 people in your business, that's what, 200,000 hours of work or activity a year that is occurring. There's no way you can really see that by walking the halls or having conversations. Are there any other lessons learned about what you did or didn't do in leading the business that you think are worth sharing with others?
Well, I'll say maintaining financial management discipline is really important. And when I first came on, coming out of the banking world, our discipline to metrics and financial management were, I mean, second to none. And over time, you're trying to grow and you start getting more committed to growth and to discipline and you justify certain things. So I would definitely say that no matter how bad you want to grow or what you're trying to accomplish, that you've got to maintain that financial discipline. Because once you start to step away from it, it's really, really hard to rein it back in. So I think that's a biggie for sure.
Do you have any examples of where growth provided a temptation that maybe drove some irrational resource allocation?
Well, I don't know if I've got one where it was completely irrational, right? I'd say that we tried to justify everything we did, right?
So wrong word. I knew it because I said it, but yeah.
Right. An outsider might look at some of what we did and said, hey, I don't see how that was rational. But yeah, I mean, we got really committed to building our IT practice. And we found an acquisition target that was in IT that was going to get us kind of over this revenue hurdle that we had been trying to get to. And looking at that deal, if I put my banker hat on, which I did not, we did this deal in 2018, I would have never done the deal the way we ended up structuring it. Ultimately, I got too committed to making the deal happen because I wanted to grow that IT business so much that I threw my instincts out the window as it related to deal structure, even some of the due diligence that kind of looked at and cast aside and justified with, well, we could just reduce expenses if this doesn't pan out quite the way we thought. That's an example. For sure, where there's so many variables to that, that I knew better, but did it anyway because, well, I'll grow us out of it, or lots of justification based on, I mean, probably ego more than anything.
Yours or someone else's?
It's got to be mine in that situation, right? Can I? I mean,
hate it when that happens. I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. I just stepped aside as CEO.
Yeah.
I hired my replacement and I've had a lot of people comment on the amount of leadership it takes to do that and that they've seen other leaders who need to do it, but they let their ego get in the way. And I think that is something that I just gave an example of where ego was a learning lesson for me, but I see it a lot. Not necessarily. I don't think if I look back on my journey, I don't think my ego has been a big problem for me as a leader, but it is something that I think every leader has to find a way to keep in check and reflect on, am I getting too big for my britches in a way? Even if it's just a specific problem or situation or issue, be willing to take a step back and listen to others and be willing to let go of something that at the end of the day isn't the best thing for your people or the organization or even for yourself at the end of the day. And ironically, even in the situation where I brought our CEO in, it's funny, I was looking for a chief revenue officer. And when I found him, that's what he had spent the last 10 years of his career doing. And I had said, look, I'm looking for someone who I think could be my successor. And he was the one who said, Mike, I really want to be a CEO now. I don't want to have to wait for that. And my initial reaction was, well, if either of us can make an objective case that it's better for the people or better for the organization, then I will absolutely entertain that. And when I walked away from that conversation, the more I looked at it, the more, because I wanted to make an objective case that it wasn't the right thing, right? What is the best thing for the business and for the customers and for the employees? And the more I looked at it objectively, I could not come up with a reason why this guy should not take my place now as opposed to somewhere down the road. And then honestly, one of the things that became very evident and clear to me as I started to entertain this decision, it's not just better for the company and for the employees and the customers. It was better for me personally. So it's going to help me obtain some professional and personal goals that I may or may not have been able to accomplish as quickly or as well without him. So I think it's really, really important to be open to possibilities and make sure you keep the ego in check.
It sounds like you also found your own reasoning as to how this helps you achieve some of your other professional bucket list items, personal bucket list items, perhaps as well. So that's neat. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the episode. It's been wonderful hearing about your experiences. Thanks for coming on the show.
I really enjoyed it, Kenai. It's been great getting to know you and catching up, and wish you all the success.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Hindsight. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a review and be sure to subscribe so you're notified each time a new episode is available.